from Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Blood Pumping, Minneapolis. This is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
I'm Sam Baseman, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy. I, too, make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are health and developing for speedrunners. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start. Sam's here. Sam.
Who's saying
here.
That?
Sam's here.
Oh my god, the voices! The voices! Where am I? Hello, everybody.
You've been sleeping here for a week on our nice pillow.
Nicegames.club/merch.
Let's go.
Sam is back. Listeners who listened last week will be, not surprised. If you're new to Sam, Sam, hello. Welcome back to the clubhouse.
Who are you?
Now I'm scared. Okay, maybe
this
I'm going to
this is the earliest we've ever
out.
Been this unhinged.
I feel like I bring this energy.
You sound like every other podcast. So let's.
Oh my goodness. Hello.
Calm down a bit.
A little.
Hello, everybody. I'm Sam Baseman. I'm a member of the IGDA Twin Cities community. I'm on the board of that, as well as the board of Nice Games Alliance, the nonprofit that we use to support it. I'm also a 3D artist by trade. I mainly do freelance work, and I'm currently working on a game called Grape Juice City, 3D party platformer coming out someday soon.
All right, that's enough of that. I released the game this week.
Yeah.
Listeners, when you hear this, it'll be a couple weeks up, but Blippo Plus is available on Switch and PC, on Steam. It's on Itch as well. I am glad we did that. So any way you want to get it, unless you have a Macintosh, in which case,
Well.
I'll make it a version for you. Sit tight.
Okay.
You can buy a Playdate in the meantime.
It's also on Playdate, but I didn't make that one, so I'm not going to see a dime.
Yes.
Right. So buy that one, because it's great.
Yeah.
Also, buy it. Buy the one I'm selling.
You could get it on Steam and Switch.
Yeah, that's true. You could, if you really care that much.
But you should.
Yeah, we were talking last week about, promoting things to people.
We are, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, the game is published by Panic.
Yeah.
It's an incredible publisher from the Northwest. And so I don't really have to worry about the things a lot of indie devs of our scale have to worry about when you're self-publishing or you're working through a smaller publisher and have to participate in a lot more of the promotion. So I just get to sort of sit back and see how it goes and then help where I can.
Yeah.
And that's been nice. But also it's a lot of I have thoughts about how we position and stuff, and it's just not my job.
Yeah.
And not my expertise. And so that's been fun. Press reviews have been coming out.
Yeah.
Couple on the first day, and then like one on the second day. And I'm like, okay, I guess that's, people, game reviews aren't that common. Indie games don't get reviewed that much.
Yeah.
But then there's been new ones every day. Including some websites that I read every day.
So
that's been quite interesting.
That's awesome.
So cool.
For The Verge to do a review of a game I worked on.
Cool.
Which is kind of incredible. The whole project. I've talked about Blippo Plus to some extent, not maybe in complete sense, but past couple months on the show, so most listeners will probably have some idea of the project, but it's weird. And I don't mean that in terms of its content, because it sort of is, but as a project, it's very strange.
Sure.
How it was produced. My involvement, I sort of lucked into it, which is great. So lots to tell about that, but now that it's out, seeing that it's 90%+ rated on Steam.
Wow.
People love it.
That's amazing.
We just unlocked the very positive thing.
Yeah.
Which is cool. And then, seeing sales roll in, looking at the charts, which is pretty good. But I'm also looking at my percent of a percent of a percent.
Yeah.
And I'm it's still I'm still making indie dev wages, which is basically no money. But it's gonna have a long tail.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Which that's very exciting for me. Career-wise, it's going to be a source of income. May not be a lot, but it's something.
Yeah.
It's a real great, because it's done, it has been received universally well. And that is a big result of what the project is and the core content of video content, that is just this incredible thing. And I'd like to think some of that is due to my assembly of all of that stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so it's been we're in the Slack that the team shares, we're all sharing all the reviews and some of the funny posts about it, People talking about like it's, you know, totally their thing, and people are like, oh, I have no idea what it is, but I saw 2 seconds of it and now it's my life. And just like, but people really fall in love with it in a way that's very satisfying. Mm-hmm. And then when they experience it, like knowing, I feel, you know, I used to be a video editor in a previous career. And one of the things about video editing that a lot of people know is that the better you are as a video editor, the less people notice you did anything. And I think my, it's frustrating to a degree, but I'm reading a lot of the reviews and I'm like, oh, they really love my work because they say nothing about it. Right. Like the experience of it is so a result of the content in it. But at the same time, like for that to be real, because I've watched all of it out of context.
Right.
And it's like, it is, every piece of it is genius. But the whole pack is, I have such an immense pride in when people talk about like the channel flipping experience and like how authentic it feels, but also like it feels so janky and weird. And at the same time, as a video game, it's very smooth and polished. In a way, like that irony was something that was very difficult to achieve. And like hearing people talk about it as just it's a normal thing that a game like this would have has been, you know, I've sort of like, oh yeah, I know, I did it.
Yeah.
I feel really, really good
about it. That's great.
So that's great. Like, it's a capping a very stressful year for me. And the year's not over yet, so who knows what'll come next. But it was.
But you got this.
A wild, wild last, you know, maybe 12 to 18 months of my life, and so this is an incredible sort of chapter point in it.
That's awesome.
So I thought I would just steal a little bit of the top of the show.
I mean, if you don't talk about your things, who's gonna?
Exactly.
It's not gonna be me. It'll probably be me, actually. I would probably do it.
Well, that's just the thing. A bunch of people have been talking about.
So it's great.
Which, you know, I mean, anyone who's like had their sort of, you know, first taste of this scale of reach for a project they've worked on, I think I'm going through all the same emotions people do. Like, oh, people... All these people are seeing it. You know, that's really great.
And it's being received very well, and it's seeing the kind of feedback that you're looking for out of it.
And just looking at those, we talked about Discords last week. There's a there's a Playdate Discord where they talked about the Playdate release, and that's where the fan base has formed. There isn't an official Discord community for the game, but the people who followed it, who are like the super, super fans of it, are pouring through every corner of it.
Oh my.
They're bending and breaking it. They're looking into the data files and wondering why I named a thing a certain way.
Oh, wow.
And, like, and they're uncovering the things that, and I'm confirming that they're Easter eggs and I'm withholding answers when they ask them.
That's
been kind of enjoyable. And that community has been really great because like they also, I mean, they get it on a different level. But what's great is how the general audience gets it.
That's good.
It's really cool. I think the one frustration I have is the sort of like, the common refrain about it that it's not really a game. It's more, and I'm like, you know what? That's fine. Like, I think that we've talked about this on the show, this idea of like where gameplay lives. And I think with Blippo, because of the way it's structured, there is so much gameplay, but it isn't in like pressing the A button. You know, in a way that is like sort of hard. So I kind of just have to let that sort of slide. But it is sort of interesting when people talk about it. Again, it's one of those things though, that you don't notice you're doing all this like, interactive work in your mind as you're piecing together narrative and going from channels and trying to, Quizzers was just on and I missed it. So now I have to wait for 3 more slots and then I need to go to this channel. And that is gameplay in a way that like it was very hard to describe as. So that, so it's very much a success on that thing. And it does remind me a little bit of what we talk about on the show all the time is like we are the vocabulary that we use, the language of how we talk about game design. And so I feel like I want to do like talks about this experience, and what the game is and how it works and how we have a limited ways to describe things to the point where people just say like, it's so different that they that its difference is like a big deal. But it, to me, I'm like, it isn't actually, I mean, it's remarkable is what it is as a piece of work. And I say that as a fan of all the parts I didn't have anything to do with. That's so I don't feel as like self-congratulatory in that sense. It's a brilliant piece of genius work apart from my involvement. But I think when people talk about it as it's so weird, I'm like, I don't know that it is so weird. It's just not what everything else in your Steam library looks like. So it's different in a technically. But like what's great about it is not that it's weird. That's not what's amazing about it. And thankfully, after everyone, you know, is done talking about how weird it is, then they talk about how great it is.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
People are getting it.
Right. Because, yeah, it kind of ties in, like, a lot of games kind of have those different types of abstractions of real world things. And I think it's just a different approach to it than you see in a lot of standard games where they have things like movement, platforming, or maybe even.
Oh, well, before we do that.
Oh, okay.
There's still some meta at the top. Sam, that was an excellent transition.
Sam, you're a listener to this program.
I'm a big fan.
So you understand how we try to like move from topic to topic. You also know how bad we are at it, right?
Oh, a little familiar.
So you are a true Clubhouse native, I think.
Yeah.
Because you really
borked
that one. Yeah.
I also just love segues.
Well, Lydia, you have some stuff to talk about.
I do. I have a bit of a rosebud thorn kind of thing. Something good. I did another webinar. It actually kind of came out something sad. I got a message on Slack from Jennifer in marketing saying, hey, we had this webinar and the person who was going to do it had a death in the family and can't do it. Mm. Would you and this other person be able to do the presentation?
Yeah. Mm.
To which I said, I think I'll be able to do the presentation. I can't do any content generation for it. Like, I can't make the presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
And she made the thing. Oh. And then we had a couple of meetings, brought in some ideas, and we got it together. And I think it turned out really well. Cool. It was about why learning as an adult is really hard and how games can help.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was cool. And I got to bring a little bit of a different perspective on it, which I thought kind of in the oomph hour, which I think also hopefully means that material is a bit refreshed for future use in our company.
Yeah.
Since, you know, it's not new, but at some point we do have to bring in the new people into the games as learning tools fold.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I'm also tired and stressed.
Aww.
I'm working on another escape room project and it's a bit more crunchy this year.
Listeners can go back to before Lydia was a permanent host on the show. We interviewed her about escape room projects.
Yeah.
That's a banger episode.
That was a really good one.
Yeah. I want to talk about some aspect of it when it's not going to be me complaining. and I might be in Chicago for helping to facilitate it, but we need to see if they can pay me to do that.
Yeah.
But then the bud is in a couple weeks, we have a PowerPoint party for a friend's birthday with my D&D group and some other people. And what's kind of fun about that, I don't have a topic yet. I have to figure out a topic. Okay. But one of my friends, Calvin, is going to do their topic on the farming simulator genre. And so I was able to be like, hey, have you heard of Verdant Skies?
Oh, let's go.
And I was like, it's local.
Oh, that's great.
We talked to the dev and it's like very similar timeline to Stardew Valley, and it's in space. And so I was like, you gotta play it. It's great. Yeah. It sounds great.
Oh, that's amazing.
So hopefully at some point Calvin plays it, but if not, it's just, you know, spreading the good word about Verdant Skies.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
You said you don't have a topic. It's not just gonna be like dinosaurs?
No, I don't have one yet.
Oh, okay. I feel like,
could it be dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Like, what about dinosaurs? So much.
You're the dinosaur person.
My brother's the dinosaur person. I just really like him.
Oh, okay. That is not the impression I've gotten, but sure.
I don't have as much encyclopedic knowledge of dinosaurs, all of that secondhand. I have a lot of enthusiasm. I have a lot of firsthand enthusiasm for dinosaurs.
Got it. Could be very opinion based.
Yeah.
That's fair. So I have news, kind of. I'm planning on.
He sounds really excited about it.
I'm really excited about it.
Is it your fishing mini games?
It's not my fishing mini game,
Lydia. I'm happy that you're helping me pick up the slack on
Stephen.
You were not quick enough on the draw this week.
No.
Just getting ganged up on. No, I'm planning
on your own good, mister.
Yeah, fair. I'm planning on participating in Ludum Dare this weekend. Ludum Dare. We never figured out how to pronounce it. But yeah, I think I'm going to try to do that. I haven't done a game jam in a little while. I did do the global game jam a little bit because I helped make music for the NES.
And you also helped at the very beginning matchmaking for people, which was really nice.
Yeah, I try to do that every year just to help out. But yeah, my plan is to participate in the jam and also maybe help out with the management of it as well.
Yeah, we're doing one of our board members is doing an in-person site for Ludum Dare for the community as kind of a test run for a new venue for Global Game Jam next year.
Ah.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay.
But also just for its own sake.
Yeah.
And so are you going to be heading out in person?
That's my plan. Yeah. Is to go there in person. It's only on the Saturday and Sunday in person, right? So yes. I don't have to be there on Friday, which is good because I think I'm supposed to be playing D&D this Friday. I don't remember. So
his calendar is packed, everybody.
Oh yeah. So busy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. We'll see what comes of it. I guess I'll talk about it next time when we meet next.
Yeah.
Talk.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. So you like bang out like maybe 4 or 5 fishing minigames that weekend? You
think? Honestly, realistic. One. Just do one. Just tight.
That's already too big. Anyways, let's talk about my topic. Talk is health. As yay. Sam transitions.
It's vaccine season.
No.
Steven, it is.
Fine. Get vaccinated. But also...
Could you make a health-based fishing game?
Sorry.
It's fine.
Would you want to?
No.
Why?
I don't think so. Let's talk about it, huh? Okay. Yeah. So, basically, the basis of this topic is a friend of mine had asked, I think it was kind of jokingly, but also I took it sincerely, asked what health is in a game. Mm. And I want to talk about that because I was like, the way I've always understood is health is like when you have a certain amount of health points, that is an abstraction of how quote unquote healthy you are and how much you're able to like do things, do the things that you're supposed to be able to do in the game. Mm-hmm. So like, for instance, I guess we were playing Overwatch 2 at that time. You know, you have your health points and once you can do everything you can always do, whether you have 2 health or 100 health. But once you have 0 health, then you're down and you can't do any more things. I guess I wanted to think.
That's a game where you can be revived, right?
You can in fact be revived.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right, right. So it's not the same as it is in a lot of other games.
Right, yeah. It's not quite 1-to-1 in that way. But I was like thinking about it. And I was also thinking about like the history of health. And Mark, you had brought up, cause I think I brought this up to you off air a little bit, about how health, I always thought that health was an abstraction and you described that like health made a lot more sense back in the day because there wasn't a lot of detail you could show. Like,
yeah, I think these days health as a video game concept is well defined.
Yes.
And actually in most games it's not state of health, it's like state of injury.
Yeah.
But like it's a proxy for how close you are to game over, right? Mm-hmm. And we understand that as a mechanic, but my point in our discussion was that the metaphor is kind of trapped in amber from the early arcade days, or even from like a D&D kind of perspective, or like hit points or whatever. That's when everything was so abstract, right? When your character was 5 pixels on a screen, when your movement was in like tile based across the like a world map,
right?
Where like so much of the experience of what you were imagining was happening was abstracted. That health fit really well into that level of abstraction.
Yeah.
And these days you have these like fully photorealistic third person action games. Mm-hmm. That have not evolved that metaphor because it's such an effective game mechanic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so
they're designed around that idea.
Because there's a lot of attempts to like for certain games, like, oh, I got hit in the arm. My arm doesn't work now. Mm-hmm. And pretty much all those games kind of fail because like they're good. They're interesting ideas, but they're not fun to play.
They're like gimmicks.
More than And I think, but because we've accepted as red, so I kind of just imagined, and your friend is not this profile I was building in my head, like someone who could view a game and be like, why is that? Like it actually is. In a vacuum, a very confusing idea.
Yeah.
If your first video games are modern video games.
If anything, I think health nowadays is more accurately potential energy. Mm-hmm. And then the metaphor on top of it or the visualization on top of it is more flexible now. Because for like example, in Subnautica, oxygen and health are separate stats.
Yeah.
But in Dave the Diver, oxygen is your health. If you get hit, you lose oxygen. But also moving around consumes oxygen and the same items give you back oxygen, which means you can take more hits or you can swim around longer. Other forms of, there's also like in Harry Potter, I remember you didn't get downed or died, you fainted. Mm-hmm. Like that was if you lost all of your health.
Right. That's so, the same in Pokemon too.
Yeah.
When you lose your health, your Pokemon faint.
Anything you sell to children.
Right.
I guess so. Yeah.
They get sent to the Shadow Realm. Yeah. They don't get killed.
Yeah.
Well,
in the Star Trek tabletop role-playing game, you have stress.
Right.
Yeah. When like Romulans are firing phasers at you, they add to your stress, but they don't hit you until the last one. Mm-hmm. Then they hit you and you go down.
Yeah.
And it fits the metaphor. But all of these things are still just hit points.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's still the it is still a volume of energy that you can then translate into doing things or being able to still do things.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting example, I think, recently that's kind of gone against this that I really enjoy. The game Peak. And how it's all based off of your stamina bar. Any items you're carrying adds to your encumbrance, which ties into your stamina, like maximum capacity.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
As well as any elemental damage or physical damage from falling occupy, like, blocks some of your stamina bar, which I think.
Yeah. And also, kind of, if you get revived because you died and then you get brought back halfway, like at a checkpoint, a little bit of your stamina bar is permanently blocked out. Like, you've lost max HP, essentially. Oh,
okay. So I have a question for you, Steven, then, is because we're kind of dancing around the difference between the metaphor and the mechanic.
Yes.
Which is the more interesting area, or is it just the intermix that's looking to explore?
It's the intermix. It's the intermix that I want to talk about. Because I think that, I think it's really interesting that, like, these examples that you brought up, Dave the Diver and Peak, like, they change the, even though it's effectively a health bar, they change the what it's called as an oxygen bar or stamina bar so that it can do more things and it can be more complete and or things can affect it and impact it.
And it can be more simple.
And it can be more simple.
Because then the economy of making sure you're functional is less complicated than it would be in Subnautica. Because I think there's health, there's food, there's water, and I don't know what else. But like that's a lot of stuff for, you know, just diving in a morning or an afternoon or
there's
evening.
There's like five different types of health in
it's
Overwatch
like,
2.
It's thematically efficient.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Right? And mechanically efficient.
Yeah.
I think something similar to that that is not as thematically efficient is the health and gauntlet.
Oh, okay.
The classic arcade
health,
gauntlet.
Not the food.
Yeah.
I haven't played personally, so I'll need a little
The
more.
Way it works is you have a certain amount of health, and it's actually a timer.
Yeah.
So the timer counts down. You have to make it to the end. That's part of the interesting way you play the game because you kind of have to like run through this gauntlet of enemies. If you stop to fight them, you're losing time.
Yeah. Mm.
But every time you get hit, you lose more of that,
right?
Like it's health.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
It's described in the game as health.
Interesting.
And you can get food and then it goes back up. But it's always counting. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. No,
it's mechanically brilliant and it's,
it does work. Yeah.
It works great. But you just kind of have to let that one go by you. It's not as thematically tied as Dave the Diver.
Yeah, it took a timer and added a health metaphor on top.
Yeah.
At least as far as like looking back.
But that makes it simple and effective and a really satisfying gameplay experience. But then it's like, okay, well, this metaphor is broken a little bit, but whatever, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I don't know. Some games can have it both ways and some games can't.
Yeah.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
And I mean, it depends on its design. What I appreciate the way you brought it up before, Mark, is that like a lot of games are designed around this idea of health, just that base idea. Like, I mean, all fighting games. Well, actually, no. I was going to say all fighting games have health, but that's not true. Super Smash Bros. Doesn't have health.
Yeah.
And that game is...
It sort of does.
It's like... What's really interesting about the way Super Smash Bros. Does it is like it's like more of a tension. Every time,
I was gonna say it literally is potential energy.
Yeah.
Because then when you get hit, the potential energy is converted to kinetic energy, and you fly off to the who knows where in the universe. Yeah, it literally is potential energy.
Yeah. And that adds tension because even if you're at 100% health, because it goes up, which is kind of weird. Yeah. But even if you're at 100%, that doesn't mean that you're out of the fight. If you get hit with a big attack, you might be able to survive still.
Right.
So, like, there's some tension in there.
Yeah, it's what I would describe as totally broken, like how it communicates to users.
I think once you
master the system, and a lot of players have, then you can understand the relationship. But if you're like, oh, this is meant to be what's the chance of me falling off the edge?
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like 112% and I'm doing fine.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't, you know, it like, there's some
presentation. Right.
There's something there.
Yeah.
But, but it is still kind of ultimately, other than the chance, the statistical component of it, like when you're hanging off the end, there's a stat, there's a die roll somewhere.
Yeah, kind of.
You know, in the background. Sure. But it's still basically a health meter.
Because that game kind of hinges, like, as a core goal for their player experiences, I feel like, on keeping the players engaged until the very last second where they're completely knocked out.
But you're totally right that, like, what it does is it provides tension in a way that, like, a very thin health bar in Street Fighter should but doesn't as well.
It adds tension, but it's a different kind of tension.
It adds
part
tension
of it is that it's like this unknowable figure, like, what does this mean? It's like
it's more
opacity is helpful.
It's more like not what does it mean, but what will this result in?
Yeah. Right.
It's like a football dropping on the ground. Yeah. It's not a ball where it will bounce in a normal way. Yeah. It'll go who knows where.
Yeah. You don't know.
It's
an
oblong thing.
Yeah.
Well, even if it's like statistically right, like 90%, right. You're definitely going to fall off this ledge.
Yeah.
Like you don't know that you're going to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is enough to make it interesting.
And there's other factors too, like what map you're on, because you could end up flinging into a wall if you're like at Hyrule Castle, in which case you're safe. But with health, if you get hit, you're going to go down.
Yeah.
Like that is the final blow. With Smash Bros, there's other variables that could save you or could make things worse.
Yeah.
So I think
there is a point where if you're, the number is so high that if you just get hit, you will fly off immediately.
Yep.
Yeah.
But like, there are so many other factors that determine if that will or won't happen that you can always keep that idea alive that it's, you know.
Which I think kind of keeps players more committed as opposed to like, well, I know if I get hit one more time, I'm gone.
Well, I guess that maybe that's the sort of pivot for this part of the conversation is like, are there systems other than that treat health mechanically different in a way that the experience is different? I still think the way the Smash, it's like, I like all the results of it, but I still think it's ridiculous as it's presented as it's presented.
Yeah,
it's very alienated to newcomers and all that.
Presentation is weird.
But
I agree with that.
It is unique and interesting and it works, right?
Yeah.
So like, is there anything else that's not just either counting down hit points or health bar or a regenerative system? Because those are kind of the two I can think of
that are
90% of games.
Well, okay, so, I mean, this isn't different from health bar, but it's a different type of health bar, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think we brought this up too off air before too, Mark, in that, like, when console games started wanting there to be shooters and stuff, they changed the design of shooting games to be, like, cover shooters.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
The reason why they designed the cover shooters that way is people cannot aim very well on controllers compared to mouse and keyboard, and so, like, you were able, when you were getting shot, if you just go into cover, you'll eventually recover your health. What that does is it's kind of like a bit of a turn-based game sort of thing. Mm. You like go in and you take your turn and you shoot them, and then as you take damage, eventually,
if you survive the turn,
if you survive all of that damage, then you go back into cover and you recover.
Risk reward, like how far am I going to go into the next area?
Right.
Do I have it? Can I absorb enough bullets to get there?
Yeah, it's a little bit of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think like people have kind of moved away from cover shooters in general because like people got better at shooting things with the controller, I guess.
That is interesting. I guess I didn't realize that was such a big factor in that pivot.
Yeah,
because we were talking about regenerative health in first person shooter games.
Oh yeah,
which I think you identified correctly as like came from cover shooters.
Yes,
that were so popular
in the same vein,
and then that it just infected the whole industry of like you should have regenerative health.
Yeah,
Kind of like how coins in Mario and lives in Mario don't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think people were kind of the idea like, oh, health doesn't matter anymore. Let's just do this regenerative thing.
Yeah,
because people are tired of hit points. That's so old fashioned. But I think people have gone back because developers didn't realize what they were giving up.
Yeah.
By changing those systems?
Yeah, yeah. It impacted things. I mean, yeah, Call of Duty is another example of that. And that's a first-person shooter. And, it had that healing. I don't know if the first one did. I can't remember. But I didn't play that many shooters. Yeah. But I know this stuff.
It is sort of weird sometimes in certain types of games where you're, like, you're wandering around with, like, 72% health or something.
Yeah.
When it's, like, there's no real interesting... That's not interesting sometimes.
Sure.
Right. Yeah,
like, in some types of... In a fighting game, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Right? And what exactly your thing is now. But if you're walking from, like, one part of the map to another part of the map between encounters, it's not really important what you're like, because it depends on, am I going to go looking for health packs or not?
Right.
That's not mechanically interesting. Just just give me 100% again.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of, it goes to level design and how well they interact with each
other. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. All of these things kind of tie into how those games were designed, how the levels were designed based around that thing. The reason why there are cover shooters is because you need to be able to find some cover so you can recover your health. Whereas like in Doom, you needed to go and look around the map to find health instead.
Yeah.
And so you would have to explore the map and you moved a lot faster and there was a little bit of cover. I didn't play that much Doom. There's a little bit of cover, but like not.
You mean
much.
Like Doom 2016?
The original. I'm talking about the original.
Oh, the original. Okay.
Yeah. 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 In Doom 2016, they changed how it worked in that like you have to run up to enemies in order to melee them in order to get your health back. And so like that requires. That requires some, what's the word? I guess intensity? You have
Hutzpah?
To like...
Yeah, Sisu?
Yeah, sure, all those words. You have to actively get your health back in a way that you wouldn't have to do in other in cover shooters.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's the like recover what you lost method, like with Bloodborne. So the idea that of a having a mechanic that rewards aggressive gameplay, because if you get hit, hitting back then will help get you recover some of what you have lost.
Yeah,
it's almost like in a weird way, it's almost more analogous to dignity than health.
Huh? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a really interesting cohesion. Observation.
Well, but it like it changes how that game, how all of these different games feel, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Instead of you like patiently waiting here to get your health back and like recover from all of this stress that you've been dealing with, you have to keep fighting. You have to constantly in combat.
There are also some games that have items or abilities that then make health more of an interesting stat to have.
Yeah.
So a lot of roguelikes, will have will have items or abilities that are related to health. So for example, like in The Binding of Isaac, there's a character named Samson, and the more that, and there is an item that mimics Samson's ability where the more that you are hit, the more powerful your attacks become.
Right. Yeah.
You get angrier. Like the idea is like you get angrier and then you get stronger. Mm-hmm. In Peglin, they have a couple different relics where if you have health at a certain level or below, like any shot that is taken 25% health or lower is automatically a crit, which means that your every peg that you activated is
this
worth
is like spreadsheet stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
That like every so many games have this exactly what you're describing, where like you can add a boost or something to your inventory that gives you twice as much power when you're at, you know, less than 1/3 health.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To encourage different gameplay styles or to balance the spreadsheet.
Right.
Yeah.
Basically. Mm-hmm. Because so much is random that like if you get heavily weighted in something unfairly, we need some mechanics to get you back in balance and in a way that's interesting.
Yeah.
The success and failure of that is varies by game, I suspect.
Yeah.
I think an example that I think of immediately when you bring that up is like Don't Starve as a game that balances like you kind of have the three vectors of like health, hunger, sanity. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish that health and hunger were more impactful on like your moment-to-moment gameplay when they're low. Mm-hmm. But they have a lot of items that will essentially heal one at the cost of another or heal one a lot but do nothing to the other. And there are different areas in the game where one will heal but you might be at risk of another. And I think
But that plus peak does bring, I think, an interesting something that I really like, which is when the instead of the number mattering in terms of like, you know, what has that changed my mission or does that or does one ability that keeps my health low mean that I can take this other ability that will then make that a more of a bonus than a deficit is having interesting conditions. Mm-hmm. So in peak, unless you take the go into the settings and turn this off, you if you're hungry enough, your fellow members will start to look like giant chickens and you are because that's cannibalism mode.
Mm-hmm.
You can turn this off, but essentially like if you're hungry enough, people start look good and you are hungry enough to eat them. And I think in Don't Starve, if your sanity
in
is low
mode,
enough,
are you allowed to eat them?
I don't know because I haven't.
That would be interesting mechanics.
I don't know. I never got that hungry when I played it with my coworkers.
Okay. As far as I'm aware, I think you are. But maybe only if they've died?
I don't know.
I haven't got to that point either.
Yeah. Which is probably good.
Yeah.
But and then Don't Starve. I think if your sanity is low enough, you start seeing things in the environment. Yes. Like it's one of those where it's like in the corner of your eye, there's a spooky shadow.
Yeah, hallucinations and you're like, appear that can like attack you physically or they can sometimes like attack like your light at night, which then puts you at danger. Basically, if you have lights out for long enough, you die.
Yeah.
Peak is also an interesting point with how they use like different elemental types of damage. I say that in air quotes on their health bar.
You can hallucinate.
Like, you can hallucinate. Or like with heat as an example, like heat is very damaging in most contexts. But when you're in the cold environment, because it has different like biome levels that you go through, basically in the cold environment, heat saves you from like the cold damage that the environment is passively afflicting on you.
I got a sugar high in a peak. I ate a big lollipop and it gave me a little bit of health and then I was like seeing rainbows and then I crashed and I lost a bunch of energy.
Okay. This game is wild, I guess.
Yeah. But it's interesting because at kind of talking to what you said, Mark, where, you know, losing an arm then makes it less interesting, like that's influencing the either because of the level or how the level has been occupied in the case of peak, which then changes your not necessarily your gameplay, but your experience of you trying to do the gameplay.
It's a stronger attempt at making it more interesting, making it more
compelling,
more complicated.
Okay, sure.
Maybe not the exact word, but I guess that's the question for you, Stephen. Is like, you know, Doom 2016, like kind of the idea of bringing that back, rejecting the regenerative health idea, and like making that a very sort of like present part of your experience. Mm-hmm. That's a choice. Yeah. Right? It's worked for that game, but not worked for every game.
Yeah.
What do you feel is more interesting, where it's the concept of health is really strong and present, or where it's not necessarily backgrounded, but like interacts with many other mechanics and numbers? Like in Don't Starve, for example.
You're asking the wrong person. If you're talking about numbers.
What's the larger potential space?
My actual answer is it obviously depends on the game. I think that I think in general, a lot of times with devs, we tend to default to things that have been done many times in the past. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes we'll just make health because Street Fighter did it or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that there's more potential to make things more interesting, like Peak. Like a lot of the things that Peak is doing is not particularly unique, but the way that they're treating the health, quote unquote, health bar, stamina bar, is unique in for a climbing game like that.
Yeah.
I think that like there's potential in making things more unique and more thematically interesting, valuable, engaging for players if you treat health. If you treat health in a way that makes sense for that game.
Right. Like an extension of your core, like ability to do the interaction that you need to do for that game.
Yeah. Yeah. It needs to be an extension of what the game is supposed to be about effectively. Uh-huh. I feel like I dodged your answer.
No, I think that's pretty good. And I think Sam kind of buttoned it with like, if that core metaphor of it being about a metaphor for you being able to do anything.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Whereas other types of things like encumbrance or other stats, strength, or a skill tree or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are different, right? Uh-huh. Even like curses or poisons or things that limit your ability. Mm-hmm. Health is very much tied. It's tied to life and death. And that is a core mechanic of video games.
Yeah.
Is life and death. And so more than in other narrative media. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, so like maybe that's something that is like keep that pure maybe? Is that
sure.
Or like mix it up a little bit. Like, because you say very game specific.
Yeah.
But is there a game where life and death is incredibly important to the play and the feel of it that sort of doesn't really deal with health?
Maybe. The one I want to bring up is Blades in the Dark. Because you can sustain injuries. But I think the mechanic that you engage with more that in a way that is familiar with the health bar is actually your stress. Because as you go through your job, in order to do things, you take on stress, and you also have vices that in your downtime either ideally take away stress, but if you overindulge can actually make things really bad.
Yeah.
And if you take on a certain amount of stress, you get a trauma. And then if you get and you go bring your stress back to zero, but you have that trauma at once you get a certain amount of trauma, then you retire.
Okay.
The idea of Blades in the Dark is that you play your characters like a car you just stole. And the idea being that like you're going to cycle through a couple characters if you're doing your job right.
Okay.
And so while injury can make doing the thing harder or different, and you have to think about like, okay, well, I've broken a leg, but I still have my arms. How can I use that?
Sure.
Your stress is the thing that gives you the ability to do as much as you want in the next mission. And if you and how you mitigate that during your downtime will then greatly influence how much and what you can do in the next heist, because you only will have so much stress that you can work with in relation to how much other stress your teammates can take on.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, is actually the closest maybe.
Yeah, I think that it brings immersion into it, right? Because actually, you're describing the system like that's exactly how Star Trek Adventures works.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like you can only sustain. So I think it's probably maybe the D20 system or something. I don't know.
This is D6s. So
yeah, but so it's probably common to a lot of other games as well. The idea of stress and then a limited amount of injury that comes from a certain amount, you know,
sure,
until then you're finally dead.
Yeah, it is the inverse, I think, of like of Don't Starve, where if you lose your health, then you die. But losing your sanity makes living harder.
Well, then I think that the immersion angle then is if health is tied to everything else, then like that is interesting, but that is also a choice that's really, really wrong for a lot of games.
Yeah.
Right? You want to be able to like it's interesting and immersive that like as your health depletes, then you run slower.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't have to be just that like you get hit in the arm and your arm falls off. Like, it doesn't have to be that. Like literal.
Yeah.
But that is fascinating for lots of types of games. But there are certain types of games where that is annoying in a way that is distracting from the experience.
Right.
And so then the health metaphor, like either you fall back to that mechanical idea from the 80s, the 70s and 80s, early arcade games and just like call it health.
Yeah.
Right? Or you, or maybe we find another way to describe what that is.
I've never,
if you're not interested in the immersion element.
I've never liked the idea of you describing health as health anyways. I've always liked it better as like stamina and stuff. But I'm kind of a person that like doesn't like the idea that Mario like quote unquote dies, and then, so I think that's that's my bias.
Well, actually, that's a great example because you get the super mushroom, and you grow, but then you get hit and you lose it. That's essentially just one hit point,
right?
But we don't think of it that way.
It's
not really health in the metaphor sense.
Yeah,
right. It's just it's almost like a piece of armor or something, which is a whole other. You know,
yeah, proxy for Sonic is weird like that too, because you hit him and he loses all his rings, but then if you get one you ring, have you're a ring. Okay.
Yeah. It changes how the play works.
It's actually kind of fascinating how far we got into the discussion without talking about Sonic or Mario.
Yeah, and,
yeah, hey, go team.
And how you and how you, especially because those are both very unique in the
conversation. That's true.
Right, and even in their time in history, when that metaphor of health and hit points was already really well established, for lots of side-scrolling games,
And they do things quite differently, and they have played around with that idea for their own in their own series, in a way that's kind of interesting.
Well, the next conversation is about lives, then I guess.
Well, sadly, it's not actually about lives. It is about something in reference to our nice thinking a couple of weeks ago.
We got to the call to action.
Never mind.
Sorry, Lydia.
Steven, you're editing this right?
No, I'm editing the last one. So
sorry, Dale.
Dale is editing this one. Yeah.
Hi, Dale.
I think I put the button on this one, and then we can go to the
call to action.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where does the call to action?
It's Patreon.
It's Patreon.
I gotcha. Sam, we should show you the Patreon sometime.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Oh, I bet.
It's got all of our episodes, and it's got all of
Wait a minute.
What?
Sam's a fan of this program.
You're right.
I'm a pretty big fan. Is there any way that I could be more supportive of this show?
That's a good point.
Sam,
dang it.
Sam, I'm asking, did you not already know this?
No, I'm well aware.
Did you know that I have pictures of my cats?
I've heard
my cat singular.
I've heard lots of compelling arguments about cats being on this Patreon.
And dogs.
Dogs as well.
God. Yep, oh my God.
Yep.
So, Steven, what are some like real reasons people would might want to do it?
Because the show costs money and we need money.
Yeah.
That's the main reason. I'm not gonna lie.
Cats and dogs are really there, but
yeah.
But they need food.
Yeah, they need food.
Yeah.
You want to feed our pets? Go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub and you can support the show that way.
So in previous Nice Thinking, Wayne's World flashback, when we were talking about ladder games, there were a couple moments when we were talking about ladder game about how the average player would be going through one of these rooms full of delicate objects with a big ladder versus how a speedrunner would do it. And Mark, you were talking about explicitly saying which path they would probably take and guessing the strategy, which then made me think about speedrunning in the development process.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly common
consideration. Yeah, that's true.
Disclaimer, I don't speedrun.
Okay.
I think it's cool that people do it. It's not a compelling thing for me, but it is something that I know is very important and is a very particular kind of challenge that itches the brain nicely.
Yeah.
I was kind of wondering if we could talk a little bit about designing for speedrunners. What, first and foremost though, not what games make good speedrunning games, but what features in games invite and facilitate speedrunning. Because I think, given how many weird speedruns there are in the world, I think that that's actually the better question.
Sam, do you watch a lot of speedruns?
Honestly, no.
Okay, so it's just
I'm familiar with like a couple different things. Like I've seen some Skyrim speedruns and some Breath of the Wild speedruns.
Okay. Got it. Okay. So I'm the only one who really watches speedruns. That's fine. So I'll answer the question, I guess. I think it kind of just depends on the community you're part of. I feel like people like speedrunning games that are weird. Like people still speedrun Pokemon games, even though those games take like 4 hours to complete, if you speed run it and they're slow and I don't like watching them.
I would say that there are certain types of games that are suitable for speed running.
Yeah.
And then there's certain types of games that people just really like.
Yes.
And then they speed run.
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of build the community around that, and then like they deal with the fact that it's not perfect for speed running because they just like it.
Yeah, so that's the thing about speed running is it's just an extension of more game. It's effectively like a longer achievement list.
Yeah, I was at GDEX this year and caught a really good talk from a friend of mine, Spencer Everhart, without going too much into it, just talking about how incorporating different, like your player into your design, like can be interesting for thinking about the mechanics of your game and considering like the interactions of a game as more of the focus than like the systems at play itself, which, I mean, with speedrunning, you're kind of considering those systems with a lot of it. But an interesting point that he made was that speedrunning can, it's sometimes effective to consider speedrunning almost as if like it's a different game using the same tools, the tools being the mechanics that you've made for your game software.
And so that, that's a good point. Effectively, I don't think you really can design, you can design a game around a certain types of players, but I don't think you can design a game around speed runners per se. You can add features that are helpful for speed runners, like a timer or something, so people can track themselves without having to use their own external timers. And I think that's helpful for people, like maybe a leaderboards, I suppose, system. I don't know that. I honestly, most speedrunners kind of just do their own thing, so I don't know how helpful that is. And I'm also not a speedrunner. I just watch people, so I know tangentially a lot of this stuff.
But a big theme of it is it's so separate from what, not just like the normal path or whatever, the normal gameplay experience, but even all of the Easter eggs and things that the developer put in, the sort of a game that is like optimized for speedrunning, no developer could predict. Right. And so I think, like you say, you can't really do it.
Yeah.
I would go further and say, like, you should not, you should put it completely out of your head. Now, that's not going to happen. Like, I think people are going to want to make speedrunner friendly games.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a little bit, in my mind, there's a little bit of like, well, then what are you really making? If like you're thinking too much about that, I guess.
Well, you're thinking about a specific type of community you want to build the game for.
I suppose. Yeah. But isn't speedrunning like not, it's about playing the game in a way that's different.
Yes.
It is really interesting to hear that, like, the joke of you can kind of speedrun everything is the beautiful point of it.
Yeah.
Like, to actually hear that that is true.
One of my favorite speedruns is Clue. And I think it was, like, on the NES or something. And because they've made plenty of video game versions of Clue. And it's like 3 seconds. And basically the way that the person sped run it is they kept picking the exact same options until those were correct.
And then
they got it. And I was like, and I watched it. And it was 3 seconds. It was great. And so I think that like, you could speed run anything. And that is kind of the point, because effectively you just want to extend your play with this game because you like it more.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's beneficial.
Games are just material for this activity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. And so there are some games that work for it, some games that don't. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, if you make a game that's very long or that has unskippable cutscenes, then like people might be less inclined to want to speed run it just for certain reasons.
Or that isn't like linear as much. Like if you have like a, like people aren't going to be able to speed run Fortnite just by virtue of how it's
made.
But
if you make your game that has, that's very like an action game with a lot of narrative focus, and you decide, well, I'm going to have a button press to skip a cutscene, not a hold for 2 seconds to skip a cutscene.
Yeah.
Even though, because I want to make sure the speedrunners don't rebel against it, then I think you're maybe going astray.
That's
you know.
I would agree with that team, but that's actually a very good point. There are things that speedrunners complain about all the time, and one of them is unskippable cutscenes.
Yeah,
one of them is what are the things?
Auto scrollers.
Thank you. I couldn't think of it. Auto scrollers in the games and things like that. Like,
it's amazing how many actual just regular gamers hate auto scrollers because of how much speedrunners hate them, because it sort of influences gamer culture
a little bit. Yeah,
That like the point of an auto scroller is to relieve you of time pressure, right, and give you different pressure.
It changes how I play.
But when your whole culture is about time pressure, then like I've heard speedrunners talk about like why would anyone even make a game a level like this? And it's like,
okay. Well, it's because they're gamers and they're not thinking about it from a developer's perspective. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of gamers sort of take that kind of as common wisdom, like yeah. auto-scrollers are stupid and shouldn't exist. You know, like,
yeah,
and I'm really flattening out that culture.
Like, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Lydia, does that help explain it a bit?
It helps a lot. It does make it, okay, so we've got materials or tools or stuff in the play space, and they are taking it and they're making it into a new play space. Mm-hmm. Then the question comes, is speedrunning something to consider in an early design process as a pillar? Mark is arguing no.
Yeah.
But I can see how, like, someone during the prototyping process was like, oh, this would be fun to speedrun. And then you go, well, wait a second. That actually sounds like something we would want to develop, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Versus even just development cost-wise.
Yeah.
Versus implementing things later if a community arises around your game. Because tools and features take scope.
Story, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think. Like
what tools and features would speedrunners actually need or would appreciate out of the box? Like built-in timers with milliseconds is the first thing I thought of. I was wondering if there were any others. Mm-hmm. And then kind of like...
Some games use them and some games rely on external ones.
Yeah.
Right.
Because communities decide what the timer is.
So exactly.
Like, sometimes if you as a developer is like, I'm going to time just when you're playing the level, not when you're in a menu or when you're in a cutscene, a community might decide because of the way the game is or what's interesting about the certain strategies.
Yeah.
They may decide that actually we should time real time. And then you wasted all your efforts on an in-game timer they're not going to use. Mm-hmm. Or vice versa. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because
some speedruns are communities do use the game.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It does kind of just depend on the game. I think in terms of like designing or adding things early that you feel like a speedrunning community might enjoy about your game, I think that that's only useful if you feel like a large part of the appeal of the game is going really fast in it.
You're right, Lydia, that my opinion is that no, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
But that isn't to say you shouldn't design, even as a pillar, an idea of an alternate play mode being going really fast through the game.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not speedrunning.
Yeah.
Because you as the developer are designing your game to be like one of the interesting ways to play it is to do it quickly. Mm. But that's not what speedrunning is.
Right.
Really.
Right. You can think of like time trials, I think, is a good example of some games will have that as a game mode. That
or, you know, you can design your game to be played at a leisurely pace, but also design things that would be fun for players if they wanted to do it as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. And that is just normal game design.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that's just splitting hairs. But I think speedrunning is really about, like, discovery and not just about following the path. You know, Mario Kart speedrunning is obsessed with shortcuts and, like, fooling the game systems.
Yeah.
Because that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's not just about driving on the track as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Which is, that's what the game is.
Yeah.
And sometimes there are speedruns that just do that because that's all that's available to the player. Mm-hmm. But
once they discover that thing, then it's just driving around the track again, but in a different way. So I kind of...
Right, but that's not... But the developer didn't design that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But they did design the game to players to play it as fast as possible.
Yeah, okay.
But they didn't design it for speedrunning.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
but they did open up a lot more opportunities for people to explore with it, because especially like the new Mario Kart having wall driving and a lot more trick-like directional mechanics, it inherently opens up a lot more opportunities for that.
And that's a good example where they did definitely design... alternate paths that are that take discovery and like speedrun instincts, but the speedrunners are going to do that and they're going to do other stuff.
They're actually, you know, it's actually interesting. I've been watching Mario Kart World and paying attention to a little bit of how it worked. They're really strict about where you can go in that game, whereas in other games they were not. And so like Lakitu will pull you up, like if you even stray off very slightly, like a couple pixels out of
that place. Scamp.
Yeah.
I think I'm bad enough at that game that I have noticed that.
Yeah.
Does he wear a little referee shirt?
No.
That would be really cute.
You could do that.
And at that point, it's his job. He really should be wearing a ref shirt.
Yeah, he's no longer that savior coming down from the clouds.
No.
I think it will be interesting to see, because I've also seen that where like someone's like, oh, we're going to cut a corner here, and the Lakitu grabs you. I've seen people be frustrated by that.
Right.
Because it doesn't reward the effort that people put in
in
the sort of speedrunning sense. And I wonder how that will affect the game in the long term.
Yeah. I mean, people are already kind of ruffled about that kind of stuff. So,
but does that mean that it will become less popular as that community will get smaller because
I don't know,
because the developer has essentially patched away all of the fun parts of speedrunning just to play it not normal.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I didn't
even though they put in tons of ways for you to like, you know, shave milliseconds off your lap time.
Yeah.
Those mm-hmm. are all the developer design that stuff. And that's, you know, if that's all it is, then I think speedrunners will not be satisfied by that.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, that's how speedrunning didn't start by people like trying to break the game. They were just trying to do things as fast as possible.
Sure, sure. But some of that's just by like superhuman reflex, not necessarily exploits.
Sure.
Right? You know, things that a normal player, even a really good player, would never reasonably do.
Yeah.
Even though it doesn't break the game.
Yeah.
You know, but there's lots of different. And all that. Then maybe that's sort of what makes speedrunning interesting. Right? Is it's not, it is not one thing.
Yeah.
Really.
Exactly.
You know, and so if a developer designs it to be one thing.
Yeah, then not at all. So, I mean, I guess you can do that. I feel like I don't think it's worth the effort to be as strict about it as Nintendo decided to do in Mario Kart World. Because I mean, I guess Mario Kart World is an online play, and because speedrunners are playing it with other people, they might ruin the game if they're all doing the exploity stuff and you're not and you don't know this stuff.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, it's like, why are you tamping down on people's fun? Is also kind of a thing. And putting in all this effort to tamp down people's fun, that feels like extra effort that feels unnecessary. I think it's important to just pick up on what audience you want for your game. If you want people to like really try to make things fast, you should allow for people to be able to do that. Design it so that people could play through the game quickly, but maybe not necessarily for speedrunners, quote unquote.
Right.
But like, it's important to just make sure that people can feel like this is important. Like Sonic games, they count up and not down, like Mario did. One of the reasons I noticed, I guess, is that like people, you can time how quickly you're going through levels. And Sonic is all about, well, it's all about speed. Sonic feels like speed, supposedly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really more about momentum than speed. But
I think another like interesting, like tangential example of how games can separate like different communities, like communities based on their different interests in play styles, is how MOBAs often have like a, or even like hero shooters that have like a, any game that has like an esports like FPS game mode or aspect to it will often have like a ranked category versus like a casual lobby mode. So I feel like if you're trying to design a game like that, then if the mechanics you have support enough of that kind of play style, then maybe it makes sense to allow people to like have a separate lobby.
Well, those are games that get exploits get patched immediately.
That's true.
Right? And so are probably not terribly speedrunner friendly.
Yeah. Because
that's the other half of it. That like you should, if you're thinking about early, like the Mario Kart world, like making it basically impossible, or them trying to make it as hard as possible to find creative exploits that they didn't design.
Right, right, right.
Mm-hmm. I think it's probably, as a developer, especially as an indie developer, it's probably useless for you to try to do things to prevent, like, not speedrunning, but just prevent things from breaking.
Yeah.
Because there are certain, like, if you want all your bugs out of the game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But if, like, someone is really dedicated to breaking it, let them break it.
Yeah. Right. Because you don't have the time or energy. It's just not worth it.
Exactly.
And your goal in bugs is experience you are designing to feel, you know, bug-free.
Yeah, it'll work.
Yeah.
But when a speedrunner, like, does something absolutely insane that no one would ever do.
Skips five levels or whatever.
And then, like, the game breaks somehow. That's not really a bug.
Because they're kind of trying to design their own experience within that framework.
Yeah, and you trying to patch all that stuff away for whatever reason is absolutely a waste of your time.
Yeah.
So it sounds, I guess, as we talked in our QA episode, the way I learned QA is it's a severity of a bug is it's a matrix between severity and how many people are affected of it.
Yeah,
so if it's something that happens all the time versus once in a blue moon. And it sounds like then when it comes to bugs and weird behavior that you're trying to decide, is it worth fixing or do you just let it lie? It really is the frequency aspect. How often does it happen?
Because it's affecting the most people that way.
Yeah, versus like, is it as kind of a proxy of like, is this findable? Because there are some, that's the difference between like an exploit of one of the 3D Mario games where running backwards actually is faster. Or no, Ocarina of Time, I think running backwards is actually faster than running forwards versus also Ocarina of Time where you can just like go to Hyrule Castle immediately.
Yeah.
You just get the Master Sword if you fall through something properly. Like that, there's a difference between just like, huh, that's weird, and that's a bug that I found that made me skip half the game.
If a player is trying to achieve that and they are succeeding in that, then that's different from someone accidentally stumbling into that circumstance.
And I guess it really does distinct the difference between like a time trial mode or a race to complete your game versus a speed running. Again, it's maybe a fuzzy definition where that line is drawn. You kind of just have to leave it up, like is your game going to work? Is it going to have people, are they going to enjoy playing it that way?
Yeah.
In a way that they are designing. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. You're not the designer anymore at that point.
Yeah.
It's they're designing an experience and they should be allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sort of like, you know, support it, right? Yeah. But you can't really ensure it
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
you can't really stop it. Now, once your game is out, because I think this is a question you were asking that I don't think we fully answered, mm-hmm. which is like, when it's out, like, how do you manage that when it starts showing up? This is where I think you can be more hands-on.
Sure.
You know what your community wants. You know what they like. Mm-hmm. They've developed their own rules about what's allowed and what's not. So now you know what's okay to patch and what things you should leave alone.
Mm-hmm.
What parts that, you know, and you can, because now you have more information to work with and you have your own, you know, you're now just you're a technician at that point.
Yeah.
You know, you've designed the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, speedrunners are playing a certain way. They're enjoying it, having fun. And you are supporting that enjoyment. But you really wanted to fix that bug. But, like, they would be mad if you didn't. So then engage. Talk to them. Like, you know, just find out. Because maybe that's mm-hmm. maybe a responsibility you have to your community.
Well, and
at least to yourself, so you don't lose that community.
It's also a resource. Mm-hmm. I like the way that you're framing it. Because, like, yeah, you can talk to the speedrunners and ask why they're using this bug. And you're like, well, I kind of want to fix it. Because, like, other people are seeing how you're doing it. Or a few mm-hmm. people are experiencing it, and it's not a thing that I intended.
And if it's a healthy community, like, you might not get blowback.
Yeah.
You also should be free to decide, like, one thing is more important than another thing.
Yeah. Right?
And you might be okay with making those people upset. Mm-hmm. But, like, you have more agency to do things about it at that stage of the game's life.
Now we're getting a little bit more into community management.
Just check out last episode. Hey, guys.
Yeah.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. So, till we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.